Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, a foot and ankle surgeon and assistant professor at Boston University Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Katrina Sanders. I'm a registered dental hygienist, consultant, international speaker, and wine lover.
And we're sisters. I grew up looking up to my big sister, Katrina.
And now I look up to my lady boss, physician sister, Elizabeth.
Together, we are working to unite the dental and medical communities in unique and exciting ways.
Welcome to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters, our monthly podcast,
where we unpack all things health related from your mouth to your toes.
So grab your flossy flops
and slide on some flippy floppies.
And let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters. My name is Katrina Sanders, your trusty dental hygienist representing the dental profession. And on the mic with me, we have, of course, my gorgeous baby sister, Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, foot and ankle surgeon out of Boston Medical. How are you today, Dr. E?
Oh, so good. I'm just living the dream. Yeah, had a great clinic day. I had a great clinic day, great academic. Awesome grand round. So I'm just doing so great. How about you?
I'm good. We're recording on a Friday and kind of winding down with my week, which is wonderful, getting ready for the weekend. And I'm so excited to have this dialogue with you today. March is nutrition month. We're walking out of, heart Health Awareness Month, and now starting to focus on something that I, as a preventive specialist, am very excited about, and that is really focusing on the role that nutrition has in our health, wellness, and vitality, not only for our patients, but also for ourselves, right? Like, we learn all the time about Maslow's and how important it is for us to take care of ourselves. And, you know, it's so funny because, like, growing up, what was your favorite meal that mom made growing up in the Midwest? Do you have one?
Yeah, definitely lasagna and spinach pie. That was what she always made on my birthday.
Spinach pie.
Yeah.
Yeah, always made that.
I believe yours was turkey, but please correct me if I'm wrong.
I did love turkey. And then she also made chicken divan. Do you remember when she made chicken divan?
It's so delicious. Oh my God.
But it's so funny because, like, growing up in the Midwest, first of all, growing up in Wisconsin, notice that the vast majority of the dishes that we said out loud are covered in cheese, smothered in cheese, or, you know, covered in cheese with, like, cream of mushroom or cream of chicken. That's, like, a staple in the Midwest. And of course, with all due respect to our amazing colleagues in the Midwest, I know there are many of you that eat kale and quinoa salads. So this is no dig on you, but we grew up in the Midwest where those hearty meals are like a staple, you know. And
but we always did have like the vegetable on the side, but it was always like the frozen vegetable that was I don't really like Brussels sprouts. Now Brussels sprouts, they're the real deal. Right.
Let's hear it for Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, by the way. Like, good for you, Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, like putting yourselves on the map. Oh, it's just so good. But I will say, you know, it's interesting. One of the last conversations that I had with mom, actually, before she passed, we were sitting around, we were having a conversation about food, actually. And I said, you know, it's interesting because you and I grew up we're kids of the 80s. I was born in 85. You were born in 87. So now you guys can do the math and figure out how old we are. But we grew up in the 80s, early 90s. And at that time, culturally, there were a lot of campaigns that were coming out around nutrition. You saw them on TV all the time, right? So, like, cereal. And they would say, part of a well-balanced breakfast. And so as a mom, working mom who's, you know, got kids at home and zipping by Costco or Sam's Club or zipping off to the grocery store, clipping the coupons type thing, you know, there was a very interesting layer of campaigns that came out really targeted towards mothers around that time that really curated what we saw as a quote-unquote well-balanced diet.
But then I remember us as kids also thinking the same thing, right? On our cereal box, we had, you know, the food pyramid. Yeah. And we were even taught in school, you know, you need these, I think it was like 8 to 11 servings of whole grains. You absolutely need it. So I'm like, oh,
whole grains down at the bottom.
I need to eat more cereal. So here I am just, you know, eating more cereal and more bread because that's what I was taught, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it turns out now we're learning that like maybe cereal isn't like the best thing to have with breakfast. So that really kind of piqued my curiosity in looking at what some of the trends were when it comes to nutrition. And again, when we talk about Nutrition Awareness Month, I think it's important for us to understand, you know, where do these cultural habits come from? Where do these really deep-rooted, impactful lessons that we grow up with or that we are now privy to in society, where do they come from? And what is it teaching us about the decisions we make about what we should be eating? And so interestingly enough, I went on this journey where I started to discover quite a bit about some of the trends. And of course, as you would see it, a lot of these trends were very much threaded or infused in what was going on politically at the time or what the economic opportunities were for our populations. So like back in the, you know, like thousands and thousands of years ago, you know, a lot of us have studied like paleo diets, for example, because thousands and thousands of years ago in that hunter-gatherer mindset, you know, they couldn't just like go to the grocery store and buy a couple of boxes of Cheerios and feed their kids with that. You know, our bodies had adapted to periods of fasting or starvation, which is, of course, where we now see people adapting trends of intermittent fasting and things like that. But even at the time, you know, again, this is thousands upon thousands of years ago with our hominids or our apes that evolved or moved us into Homo sapiens as we see them today. We've seen what their skulls look like, right? Like even our primates have a smaller portion of the top part of their skull and then a larger jaw. And that was really done intentionally because our brains in the hominids or the ape generation, our brains were very small, these large, powerful jaws. And our digestive tract really is what occupied a lot of our blood vessels. And as time, as we started to move into the out of that Mesolithic era, where hunter-gatherers, by the way, we've seen skulls, no history of decay or gum disease in any of those skulls, probably because we didn't have a massive influence of sugar at the time. But as we started to see an evolution of that human jaw, the reason why we saw an evolution of the human jaw is because our brains started to get bigger. And as our brains got bigger, it changed the shape of our skulls. So now our brains needed to expand. We needed more room. And that, of course, caused the jaw itself to compact a little bit. And in tandem, that also meant that our brains required a lot more oxygen. They were, you know, our brains were absolutely needing more blood vessels. And so our digestive tracts got smaller. So that really kind of created a lot of that change. They also think that when Homo sapiens discovered fire and we were able to cook with fire, where fire was now softening our food for us, so our massive jaws didn't have to do as much crunching and moving around, that really cooking with fire created quite an evolution for us, that now we weren't necessarily eating those raw foods anymore. So yes, we saw that massive evolution, which I think is just fascinating for me as a dental hygienist, right? To see what that movement looked like for us, moving from vegetarian, you know, eating roots and turmeric and things like that into eating meats. And of course, then cooking with fire is where we saw that massive evolution or that shift. And then, of course, we saw agriculture. Elizabeth, you and I grew up in Wisconsin, right? Where I know everybody in California thinks that happy cows come from California, but we think that happy cows come from Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely.
And do you remember like going to the zoo and learning how to like milk a cow and learning about pasteurization and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That agriculture really kind of shifted a lot of that physiology for us. We didn't necessarily have to adapt to starvation or intermittent fasting because we were growing wheat, corn. We, you know, had pigs, cows, goats on farms. And so, of course, that absolutely created a little bit of a change in that basic level or that basic need for food. enter the Industrial Revolution. And really, for my dental colleagues, this is important. This is really where we began to see the introduction of the quote-unquote modern diet, where we saw tooth decay and crooked teeth begin to appear. Really, it was after the Industrial Revolution when we started to see that movement into processed foods. And so that Industrial Revolution created a change where our jaws weren't necessarily needed anymore to chew food the way that our hunter-gatherers and even our agriculturists had needed. And so we started to see that movement. Our jaws changed. The shape of our jaws changed. This is where we started to see a focus on orthodontia. And then, of course, we started to see that movement into tooth decay. Wouldn't you know it as well, around that Industrial Revolution is when we started to see an increase in things like cancers and, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes, that historically we absolutely saw from a cultural standpoint that our diets started to then subsequently introduce some of these newer diseases. And so it's incredible. You know, we even have wonderful amounts of research out today. But what you talked about, Elizabeth, was really the movement into that food pyramid. And the food pyramid came after the introduction of the microwave in the 1950s. The microwave changed a lot, wouldn't you say, on how we ate. You know, you could get a TV dinner and boom, shakalaka, you'd have dinner.
That's absolutely right. And like, yeah, growing up as a kid, you know, mom would say, oh, for lunch, you know, yeah, put in a TV dinner. I mean, we made a lot of mac and cheese.
We made a lot of
mac and cheese.
This is not an episode sponsored by Kraft Macaroni and Cheese, but it should be.
But it's delicious. Yes. And a lot of pizza rolls, you know, things like that, mm-hmm. things that are easy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we started to see that movement into convenience. And interestingly enough, it was a balance. We saw that, you know, yes, women had entered the workforce, for example, during the Great Depression, you know, World War I, World War II, when our troops were overseas. So that really created a different dynamic, too. Women were the ones that were doing a lot of the cooking and preparation. And so we did need to see society help and support women in being able to prepare meals for their families. So we saw like the introduction of fast food, McDonald's, right? We started to see the use of that microwave, which certainly allowed for convenience. And then it started to snowball. We started to see like Lunchables, right? Which I always joke, you know, those of us who love a glass of wine and a charcuterie board on a Friday night, you're basically having like an adult Lunchable, right?
That's exactly right. And instead of a Capri Sun,
instead of grape juice, you're having fermented grape juice, right? So there you go. But yeah, we started to see that infusion. And so we're kids of the 90s where we had, you know, Dungaroos and Koala Yummies and Lunchables and fruit roll-ups.
Well, then also remember things like Splenda and artificial sweeteners. And you think to yourself, oh, this is great. It has no calories. And I do remember mom even saying that, you know, even while she was pregnant, she was advised by her doctor not to do it because there just wasn't enough research. But there's this access to exactly easy things. But I like that you're mentioning all of this.
Yeah, I think it's important because it really, from a societal standpoint, that's what everybody was looking at. And so I think that is such a great segue to talk about the food pyramid, which first came out in 1992. Gosh, there's a lot of drama about that first food pyramid that came out. You know, this is not a political statement. This is just reporting what it is that we see. Because there's going to be somebody that slides into my DMs and argues with me about this, and I totally understand. But our original food pyramid, there are a lot of position papers on the original food pyramid that said that true key nutritionists early on did not recommend that every American eat 6 to 11 servings of bread or grain products, that perhaps there was an influence from the wheat farmers who were funding this project, you know, that our beef cattle farmers had a bit of an influence in what this pyramid looked like. But I will say something for this food pyramid. The original food pyramid that came out, and we're all picturing it, right? Like, the bottom tier is, like, all of those, like, grains and whatever. And then, like, the top is, like, just a little bit of, like, oils and sugars and butter, up at the top, right? Yeah. But what it did was it created this concept that we need to have a diverse diet. And part of the challenge that we see when we see trends around diet, so I'm thinking like keto, paleo, you know, Atkins, Weight Watchers even, when you start to see some of these trends moving, oftentimes focused around weight loss, not always, but oftentimes focused around weight loss, we start to see that there's not necessarily a diversification of diet. What we oftentimes see is that for Weight Watchers, you find like the handful of things that are low numbers of points, but they're foods that you like. And so people tend to stick to a relatively bland and straightforward diet. We don't see that diversity of infusing colorful vegetables, dark green leafy vegetables, lean meats. We know how important, for example, our fish is for our linolenic. Our omega-3 fatty acids. And so it's really important for us when we look at diet to really look at the diversification of the food pyramid. So my question to you, Dr. Sanders, is when we look at that food pyramid, we now see the, what's it called? Choose My Plate, I think it's called now, is the newest one that has come down from our government. And this one is more targeted and focused on your age, your gender, your activity level, you know, your anticipated specific dynamic activity, SDA, you know, we'll have him on the pod at some point, but our brother is a triathlete, right? So like what Robert's going to eat the day before a race is going to be different than what I'm going to eat a day before recording podcasts back to back and sitting on my butt the whole time.
Or even what he's going to eat on a daily basis. Yeah, correct. Absolutely.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on this new pyramid that's come out?
I think it's very interesting. I absolutely do. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that, for example, from an age perspective, your dietary and your nutritional requirements are very different. And then also your activity level and your energy level. So it does make a lot of sense. I mean, any sort of guidelines that may be made, I do think that they always need to be updated, right? Like, okay, this is the new thing right now, but we constantly need to be updating them. But I do think it's a very interesting concept. I've been doing a lot of research on like an anti-inflammatory diet, which I think is very interesting. And what they talk a lot about is the types of foods that lead to like an inflammatory cascade. For example, what it would be measuring the different anti-inflammatory markers like interleukin-6 or C-reactive protein in what you certainly eat. And a lot of they're saying foods like refined sugars and butter and things like that, that's really going to lead to an inflammation in your diet. But the best diet overall would be a high fiber, plant-based diet. You know, and they say even like meats, or even if you like were to eat a meat, if you even add something that has antioxidant properties, like let's say you eat meat and you add avocado to it, it's still going to decrease your inflammatory markers. Like if you eat the meat alone, it's going to increase your inflammatory markers. But if you add avocado or something that's an antioxidant that provides oxidant capacity to break down the cholesterol in your diet, that it actually will still help you with the inflammatory markers. And we do know that these inflammatory markers really lead to cardiovascular disease, to high cholesterol, to diabetes. So I do think it's really interesting. I think plant-based diets are really going to be are really essential, but I do think people need protein, and it's really difficult for people to really understand where to get protein in their diets, you know, especially with just vegetables alone. I think it's a very interesting concept. I also wonder, like, there's a part of like protein and grains. I mean, So, and there's, I know we talk about in another episode about like celiac disease and, but in a lot of that, like any sort of allergies that you may have, that's going to contribute to what is recommended. But I also think dairy, like, is it, dairy is like milk is something that we drink as children to basically put on weight, right? Is it really something that we should be eating or drinking as adults?
Sure.
You know, it's a very
good question. They say, you know, humans are interesting because we are the only mammal that continues to consume milk beyond infancy.
That's right.
In every other mammal, you know, they consume milk because, you know, particularly when we're talking about like breast milk or, you know, milk that comes from a mammary gland, has high levels of, you know, our immunoglobulins. We do see some really nice transfer of immune components and protein in breast milk. Which I think is amazing. But yeah, you're absolutely right. But yet, think about the campaign. We all remember milk does a body good, right?
That's right.
And remember those milk mustache campaigns. So again, those campaigns were getting put out. And yes, we do know that milk is, you know, calcium dense, and it is really important for growing bones, growing teeth. We understand the importance of that. But the idea being, as we start to mature, as, you know, women move into the postmenopausal, you know, age, et cetera, as our body changes and evolves, our dietary needs are different. And you really brought something up that's really important. And I think this is why I really like the shift from what the food pyramid was to this like choose my plate concept, is that to your point, we can see like complete proteins when you pair an incomplete protein and another incomplete protein together. So oftentimes when we're talking about an appropriate diet, it is the combination of the foods together. If you're going to have a lean meat, was it seared with olive oil? And, you know, we know that olive oil, you know, has a lot of excellent properties to it. You know, if it's well filtered and it's a high quality olive oil. So I think that's what I really love about that concept is that balance that we're starting to see that some food products are going to help lean into others. And the other thing that I did want to share that we are seeing in some of the challenges or the interpretations, you know, you mentioned like a gluten-free diet, for example, or, you know, vegetarian or vegan diets, that sometimes we assume when, like, at least for me, I assume. And we all know what happens when you assume. But I assume when a parent...
Dad used to say that all the time.
But, you know, when I get a vegetarian in the chair, I assume that that's somebody who's super health conscious. And so when they're vegetarian, they're like, I'm, you know, quinoa and kale and, you know, plant-based. And but yet, like, Pop-Tarts can be vegetarian.
Mm-hmm, good
and
point.
Pudding could be vegetarian. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we oftentimes forget that just because somebody's vegetarian or vegan doesn't necessarily mean that they're just eating incredible amounts of fruits and vegetables and, you know, whole grain, you know, carbs, you know, we could also be considering that these individuals are eating, you know, foods that are going to displace other nutrient dense foods. So we know, for example, like carbs. Why does everybody love carbs? Because when you feel bad about yourself, you eat carbs and you feel better. No, I'm kidding. It also staves off hunger or satiety, right? Like you eat, you know, something with a crusty bread in it. You take crusty bread and drag it through a very dense pasta sauce, right? Like you're going to fill up well.
But I wonder if that's also something that we've kind of taught our bodies, right? Like we grew up eating that bread and it was a comfort thing. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I'm a huge fan of carbs and I used to eat it all the time. But it's like a thing that you remember your body feeling a certain way eating it. Are we really even supposed to be doing that? Like, are we even really supposed to be eating meat? You were talking about how our jaws are, you know, not necessarily fit to be eating that. Just very interesting concept.
It is. It is. And so I think what we've started to see now is an evolution into there's a multimodal facet to all of this. So it's not just, hey, people are adapting to very specific targeted diets. And it's not just, oh, we don't know what to buy off the shelves at our grocery stores. But there's so many facets to this. But what we've seen is that there are there are large populations of individuals worldwide that are experiencing massive deficiencies. For example, iron deficiency affects more than 25% of our people worldwide. Most individuals at risk are going to be our youth, menstruating women, pregnant women, vegetarians, and vegans, because we know that oftentimes iron is going to be, or rather protein sources are going to be an excellent source of iron as well. Vitamin D deficiency affects about 42% of Americans. Those truly at risk for vitamin D deficiency are our geriatric older adults. About 75% of older adults have a vitamin D deficiency. 82% of our patients that have a darker skin. Vitamin B12 deficiency affects more than 20% of our adult Americans. This is, of course, why we see everybody getting B12 injections.
Yeah, because it can't be really absorbed.
That's right. And we know that the most natural source of vitamin B12 is going to be animal fats. So who's going to be our true targeted population who's likely going to have a B12 deficiency? Our vegetarians and our vegans. And in fact, interestingly enough, a lot of times our vegetarians and vegans are very focused on getting protein. And so they're pulling, you can get protein from broccoli, you can get protein from, you know, peanuts and things like cashews and things like that. So they're usually okay in their amino acid intake. It's really their vitamin B12 deficiency that's a problem. We know that calcium deficiency is a major issue, particularly in our adolescent population. And actually about half of our U.S. population consumes less than the required amount of magnesium, which is a problem. We have about 16 million Americans who have a vitamin C deficiency. This is really kind of amazing when you take a look at the amount of deficiencies that are happening. So I guess this is the part where I want to move into the provocative part of the talk, which is, this is our favorite, right? Which is, we know that we've received all of this kind of conflicting information, right? Over time, we've seen that certain stakeholders have put commercials out or have had an influence in what our resources are telling us as Americans to eat, not consume, etc. And then we see these deficiencies that are happening. And, you know, of course, it goes without saying, but we understand that there are overt levels of dental disease, inflammatory disease, cancers, that, I mean, the current statistic right now is 1 in 3 cancers could have been prevented if we would have followed appropriate preventive measures like tobacco cessation counseling, exercise, appropriate diet, putting sunscreen on. I mean, so prevention is so important. We understand that. I don't mean to tell everybody, you know, here listening that. The question then becomes, what is it that we're actually doing as medical, as dental professionals to help our patients? So tell me, Dr. Sanders, like, what would it look like? What would tell us in the medical community that we need to talk to this patient about nutrition?
Yeah. And it's funny, as you were talking about it, I was thinking about my patients. We all know those patients who, I mean, you're in the dental field, so you may have patients who come to you complaining of mouth pain, but I'm sure you still get these patients who just complain about everything, right? Like, you're like, okay, I know you're here to look at my mouth, but I have this chronic fatigue. I have sharp, at least for me, it'll be like, I have sharp shooting pains all over my feet. I feel fatigued. My stomach hurts. And it's funny, you're talking about these new vitamin deficiencies, that it's not just that we're not getting these in our diets or we're not taking a multivitamin. Because I'll ask my patients, do you take a multivitamin? And they'll say, yeah, I do. Or a lot of the times they'll say, I just had this patient the other day. Yeah, I tried, but my stomach just won't let it. And it's like, well, your body's also not absorbing it, because right. You're not letting your body absorb it because of your terrible diet. You're in a state of chronic inflammation. So yeah, you're diabetic and you're obese, but your poor protoplasm is basically that you're starving your body of good nutrients. So a lot of these patients,
I want to amplify what you said, because that is so important. In a world of just overt obesity, that really overt obesity in many ways is overconsumption, but undernourishment.
That's a great way of saying it.
And that's so important. I mean, we have to take a step back and really look at that. We know that fat cells release reactive oxidative species. Like, fat cells release free radicals. Yes. Like, it's really incredible. Fat cells release their own inflammation.
That's
where we see high levels of those inflammatory markers. You were talking about your interleukins, your tumor necrosis factors, like all of your C-reactive proteins. Like, fat is literally leaching inflammation, free radicals. And these are in populations of individuals that are over-consuming but are undernourished. So thank you. I just wanted to amplify that because that's such an important aspect of the conversation that I think a lot of us are missing.
That is so true. And now that you're talking more and more about that, I don't really, like, I'll try to supplement with my patients, right? I'll try to say maybe you should be taking a multivitamin. But I don't really... probably because I don't really have the time to, right? I'm given like 7 minutes per patient a day. I kind of focus on what they should be supplementing with, not necessarily telling them what they should be taking away from. And if I do think that's something that we should be talking to our patients more about, but I'll talk to them about, you know, taking a multivitamin. My patients who complain of nerve pain, I'll definitely talk to them about vitamin B12. I'll definitely, anyone who's experiencing some sort of what I think is like an electrolyte imbalance, I'll talk to them about magnesium, drinking more water, which I think everyone needs to be doing more of, drinking more water, right? A lot of my patients with a lot of chronic fatigue or chronic pain, you know, the ones that you think, oh, this is fibromyalgia. When we were in Puerto Rico, we'd be like, fibromyalgia? Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Got it. I will talk to them about like anti-inflammatory supplements, but specifically I'm like, I do recommend turmeric. I don't know if you've ever taken it. I swear by that.
Do you encapsulate it?
I do.
Okay.
Apparently it's better to actually take the actual turmeric opposed to the curcumin because it definitely has the better antioxidant properties. But they even say like a half a teaspoon of garlic a day, great for anti-inflammatory processes. And then also like ground ginger. And these are things that'll really help just decrease the inflammation in your body, decrease the C-reactive proteins and the interleukin 6, and prolong your longevity of life. But these are, you know, I don't get a lot of time to talk to my patients about that. I think a lot of it is my surgical patients. So if I have a surgical patient, especially one that I'm going to do like a crazy diabetic foot reconstruction on, I'm going to talk to them about their diet perioperatively. So obviously they need to be eating more protein, lean proteins, good fiber, and then supplementing with vitamin D and calcium, you know, to help them heal. I might even recommend like collagen or keratin or something like that. I will admit I need to do better. And I'm so glad we're talking about this topic because nutrition is something that I just love like researching and love talking about. But I think it's also something that we really don't know a lot about.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, one of my dear friends, the dental community, is going to be like, oh, I know him, but Uche says, and he's absolutely right, dental hygienists actually get more training in school on nutrition than medical doctors do.
And I believe that. Yeah.
It's so interesting. And absolutely, a dental hygienist, like we have the time. Like your patient is sitting there, their mouth is open. You know what I mean? They're listening to your stomach growl in their ear. They got nothing else going on. Like this is your chance to really talk to them. And honestly, I don't know. I got so excited when you were talking about, you know, like ground ginger and turmeric or curcumin. You know, B12, I would imagine it combats diabetic neuropathy, or at least we started to see that interdependent relationship, right? So I understand why you're making those recommendations or prescriptions rather. We're providers. We don't recommend anything. We prescribe it, right? Because we tell the patient this is going to help support you. But it's really incredible to think about food. Food can heal you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing. You know, we send our patients out with anti-inflammatory medications all the time, right? Like when we do tissue grafts on our patients, we put them on Medrol dose packs mm-hmm. because you know, we want to be able to reduce that inflammation. And yet it's really incredible. Like, your food can heal you. Your food can also make you very sick. And that's really the dichotomy of, you know, making those choices about what you put on your plate, which I just think is absolutely incredible. You know, I think the lesson is there's so much out there that we don't know. I think we learn the general basics. In dentistry, we learn the general basics primarily around the types of foods that'll cause cavities. You know, it really wasn't until recent that we started to explore, food or nutritional supplementation can also help not only with inflammation, but to your point, you know, vitamin D, calcium, vitamin K2, how important are those in bone health, which I know is very important for you as a foot and ankle surgeon, and is also important for us when we talk about patients who have gum disease and, you know, subsequent periodontal disease where it's affecting the alveolar bone. So it's just, it's incredible to me. And yet, how many of our patients, to your point, you said it earlier, you know, I take this vitamin supplement. Well, how do we know your body's absorbing it? Mm-hmm. How many people actually get a nutritional panel to understand? Vitamin B12, for example, you have to have the intrinsic factor. There's a very specific glycoprotein that has to coat B12 because B12 is kind of sensitive. And so it requires this like little escort. I call it the intrinsic factor, that glycoprotein. It needs an escort in order to bring it to your small intestine. And if you're not bringing in B12, your stomach's going to go, well, I'm not going to make intrinsic factor anymore. Why would I waste my time doing that if I'm not seeing any B12? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what about our fat-soluble vitamins? You know, I mean, we talk about our obese patients. What about our anorexic patients where, you know, or our bulimic patients, our patients that have eating disorders like pica? You know, pica is an eating disorder where you eat non-nutritive items like raw potatoes, flour, you know, things like that, paper, dirt. And we do believe, that, you know, that individuals who have those types of, you know, disorders also have robust amounts of nutritional deficiency. Think about your bulimics. That food never makes its way all the way to the small intestine in many cases. And, you know, so these are concerns that we're absolutely seeing. And I think it goes back to, so who's a great candidate for a nutritional panel? In my opinion, if that patient has a disease process that you're treating, perhaps that person is an excellent candidate for a nutritional panel to better understand, you know, should we be prescribing this patient something, or is it just better to go back to basics? You teach a man to fish, they fish for a lifetime. You give them a fish, they'll eat just for that day, you know? So the idea being, I think there are really opportunities for us to serve our patients in a really profound way.
That's a really good point. We can easily, you know, recommend supplements, but really the diet, there are so many, you know, vegetables and fruits that provide all of those things. Very well put.
Absolutely. So I think this is wonderful. I think we have to do a follow-up on this. We'll have to, you know, find another month to really deep dive into some of the specifics around nutrition and the dialogue that we should be having with our patients. But we'll have to hang up the microphone for this month. So thank you so much for joining me and my sister, Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, as we brush up on Nutrition Month. Join us next month as we discuss organ and tissue donation awareness.
We promise to keep you on your toes. I love you.
I love you. Thank you for joining us for another monthly episode of Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters.
Thank you for being part of the change we need to see in the medical and dental professions.
Join us next month for another sister-to-sister chat about other unique, interesting, and perhaps provocative and disruptive health topics.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a fabulous review.
And we'll catch you next month for another episode of
Floss and Flip Flops
with the Sanders Sisters.
I love you, Kinka.
I love you, Izzy.